We have a good connection this time. I'm happy with that. I had a little trouble hearing you last time.
Right, I'll just introduce us, Carla. Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today sees the return of Carla Urquhart McCarty from the Love and Light Research, and we're going to continue talking about her book called The Choice. And I'll ask you initially, Carla, to come onto the program. I'm not sure whether our listeners heard you when you had a few words at the start, so can we say hello?
We can indeed. It's so good to talk to you again, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah. Oh, very well, thank you. Yes, getting excited as we're getting nearer to 2010, because every month that goes by means we're getting a little nearer, I think, to something a little bit special happening. Now,
indeed.
For the benefit of listeners who don't know much of your background or might not remember it, I'll just mention that you are a Christian mystic, a librarian, and an author of a number of books, and with Don Elkins you have investigated the UFO phenomenon, and this led to you starting telepathic channeling and I believe trance channeling with space beings. So would you like to add anything to that, just so that our listeners will know what you're about and perhaps how you came to tie in with Don Elkins?
Certainly. The way I came to tie in with Don Elkins was half a century ago now, when I was 19 years old and in college. I was looking for a silent meditation group, and synchronistically, across the street from the Arts and Sciences, the Speed Scientific School, which was an engineering school at the University of Louisville, had a professor, Don Elkins, who was fascinated with the paranormal. And since the mid-50s, he had been researching everything from reincarnation to the paranormal with J.B. Ryan. He had many conversations with him. I think maybe he may have even given J.B. Ryan the term paranormal, which he began using after that.
Yes.
He investigated a lot of the UFO experiencers of the 50s, back in the day when there was no ridicule lid here in the United States. So there was a lot better degree of information, and he had very many good interviews with people like Dan Fry and George Hunt Williamson and people that were doing substantive work. He found some material from a group in Detroit called Man, Consciousness, and Understanding, which was collected after a psychic UFO experience was had by a fellow named Walt Rogers. And in this brown notebook, so-called material, the instructions were given by the alleged UFOnauts as to how to generate UFO-type messages.
Yes.
Without having the messy business of having to have a close encounter of the third kind. And Don was very interested in this. So he set up a silent meditation group according to the dictates of this instruction. And I heard about it and said, could I join? And so 12 engineering students and I, the poet from across the street, began the Louisville group, which eventually became Love and Light Research, or LL Research. I did not want to channel. I wanted to have silent meditations. So I didn't start channeling for 12 years. I didn't start until 1974, when all of the original channels had finished their education, gotten jobs, gone all over the United States, and a couple even in Europe. And the group had scattered, basically, and Don was frustrated because he could not continue his experiment, which he felt had yielded rich results. So I learned to channel, and once I started channeling, I've always been a reluctant channel, but I immediately perceived that the material was being used by people right and left. They were really giving me a lot of feedback that said, keep on with this, please. So I worked through the decades after I started in 74 to try and improve my ability to do this channeling. I found that it is easy, relatively easy, to pick up information as it is called channeling. I also found that it is excruciatingly difficult to do it well. And so that became my goal as a researcher. By this time, I was Don's partner in LNL research. And
yes.
I really felt that I wanted to give it my utmost efforts. And so through the years, I began to see various ways I could improve. And I don't know if you want me to go into how you can improve channeling, but there are ways. And I really focused on them and gradually came to feel that I had sort of maximized what you can do intellectually to be a better channel, and that is to tune as if I were an instrument ready to, as if I were a piano ready to go into concert A tuning so that I could be played by the Creator, by the Spirit, and sing as true a note as possible every time. And also I learned to channel, to challenge spirits, and that is very important. Other things I learned very quickly are, number one, if someone asks a specific question, let somebody else other than the Confederation of Planets answer that question. The Confederation contact is strictly a spiritual contact, and unless you want to know about spiritual principles, it's pretty useless to you. You need to go to a psychic, an inner guide, somebody that can tell you what you want to know. The
yes.
other thing that won't work for this particular kind of channeling is any kind of fear-based information.
Mm.
Fear-based questions carry a heavy energy that pulls down, detunes the channel, so that you lose the channel that you originally had, and you start getting very mischievous and sometimes negative entities that either want to play with you or they want to mislead you. So
yes.
I have gradually through the years I've developed a protocol for questions, and if I get fear-based questions or specific questions, I send them to somebody else. If I get questions that are borderline, I think, you know, here's how you ask that question. And then I say, what spiritual principles should I think about in working with what's on my mind, and here's what's on my mind. That way, even if it's borderline specific, you won't get any specific information, but you'll get everything they can tell you about the spiritual aspects of your interest.
Mm.
So I started channeling in 74, and I always said, if people stop coming, if people stop finding this to be a service, then I'll just go back to cataloging LNL Research's library. And I've never been back to catalog it yet.
Right. Yes, I can remember many years ago, before I got into this fully, seeing articles that came out of LL Research. They were quite popular, and no doubt they still are. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe your book is really, in some ways, a compilation of all the messages that have come since it began in the 1950s. Would that be correct?
Well, kind of. The original five volumes of The Law of One material from Ra are the only work that I have ever done in trance, and they really do seem to have their own level of excellence that I've not been able to achieve in conscious channeling, although a lot of people find them dense and difficult to read and like my conscious channeling better. But
yes.
the original stuff is the raw material or the Law of One. And in 2001, I attempted to give an easy-to-read explanation of the principles of the Law of One in a book called A Wanderer's Handbook. And I discovered after that came out that although it was very popular, a lot of people still had trouble reading it. So the present volume, Living the Law of One, 101, The Choice, is the product of my determination to write a true entry-level document that reports on the principles of the Law of One as given by the Confederation. And I discovered that here in America, our average reading level is 7th grade, which is abysmal, but that's the way it is, and that our average educational level is about 11 and a half years, just quite shy of a high school degree.
Yeah.
So I would write each chapter of the book, and then I would comb through it and comb through it again, taking out anything that you didn't know by the time you were a junior in high school, and simplifying language. It's not a dumbed-down version at all. I don't leave anything out, and I am as fully explanatory as possible. However, the words are short, the sentences are short, there's a lot of space, there are a lot of short paragraphs. It's designed to be truly entry-level, and the feedback has been very good on this book. I'm excited now because I'm working on the second chapter of Living the Law of One, 102, The Outer Work. 101 is about the basic bullet that you need to know in order to graduate. 2012 is coming up. We all want to graduate. We want to make that harvest. And if you read 101 and do the very simple things it suggests, you'll graduate. So that was the first priority, to get that out there so that people could do the work that they wanted to do as they were awakening. It's really a companion book for when you awaken and go, oh, there's more to heaven and earth than was dreamt of in my philosophy, Horatio. So, the second book goes into the work we do every day with the outer world, and it's called 102, The Outer Work. These are for this book is for people that want to get a handle on how to live every day, not necessarily to be high flown and to do idealistic, you know, arcane work in consciousness or be magical or anything. It's just like, what about my marriage? What about my job? What about I'm homosexual? How do I deal with that? How do I deal with the fact that I either have an abortion or I have a child out of wedlock? What do I do? And so that's the book that I'm working on now, is really an attempt to ground us in how to work with those lower three chakras, the chakras of sexuality and survival, personal relationships, committed relationships like your birth family, your marriage family, your job, and then on into the open heart. So I look forward to getting chapter 2 done by Christmas, and I will keep on working. Hopefully I will have it out sometime by the end of 2010. And then I get to go on to 103, which is the last of the three volumes, and that will take up higher chakra work, magical personality work, and consciousness. So it's just a splendid, I wake up every morning, I just can't wait to get to my office and get to work.
Wonderful. You're a busy lady. Now, before we move on to other questions about the book, there's one thing connected with Don Elkins that I think is fascinating. I gather that at one time he was into hypnotic regression, and I don't know if this was a result of it, but do you know the details of when he met UFO contactees? I'm just curious to know how it came about and who he met, if that is known.
Oh, sure. Yes, he was very interested in hypnotic regression, and in the early 70s, after I had gone to work for him, we flew all over in small planes. We were MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network.
Oh, yes.
And Flying Saucer Review and others, they would hear something, and they'd say, Don, can you go to Tennessee or can you go to Ohio and check this out? And we would fly in a small plane. He was a pilot as well as a professor. And we would talk to the people, and it was very interesting. And he only did this, though, I want to say, Mike. He only continued being a field operative until he had thoroughly convinced himself of the reality of physical UFOs that made dents in the ground, that, you know, the people got out and talked to us, and they took us on board, and they took them places. And I remember with great fascination those days because of the fact that the the stories really are highly strange. And so one would get the feeling of moving into fairyland or some mythical landscape where these things were possible. But they were obviously happening. Don talks to people like Orfeo Angelucci, like I said, George Hunt Williamson, Dan Fry.
Right.
If you can name somebody that was being visited and that talked about it in the 1950s, Don probably got into his plane and went and talked to them in person. There really weren't any people that had a lot of publicity at that time that he heard about that he didn't follow through with. So he was very well known at that time and through the 70s. But when he finally was convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that the physical UFO was here, and that it was here in many different guises and different descriptions, and obviously from different places, and with different looking ETs on board and so forth, he set that aside. He resigned as a consultant and focused on the message. He focused on the channeling because he really felt that the fruit of all of his work from the last 25 years, especially when he hit the law of one material that started coming through in 1981, he felt this was the culmination of his life's work. And he focused intensely and completely on that until he died in 84.
So it was he aware of where the space contacts came from that gave him the messages to the part of the LL research?
Where you mean from what planetary influence?
Yes, that's right, yes.
The planetary influence of those of Ra was said to be Venus. And there were others that were said to have come from some of the nearer constellations and planets, you know, planets of stars like Deneb and Arcturus. If you've heard, you know, it seems like on a cosmic scale, it's the neighborhood. So the ones that we have focused on the most have come from Venus.
Right, yes. So I guess Don must have had an interest in George Adamski's contacts because he was contacted by the Venusians.
Indeed, he went out to Giant Rock, and that's the right George, right? The one that's at Giant Rock. There was one in California, and there was one at Giant Rock, and I get the two mixed up. One created the Seven Principles books. The other created a large chicken coop that was supposed to be turned on at some point by the UFO-nuts, and it never was. But Don always said that he could see the Integratron every time he went down the localizer into Los Angeles. He could spot it off to the left. So, yes, he spent over a week at Giant Rock, and he also visited the fellow with the Seven Principles, both Georges. He knew personally. And
yeah.
with great cordiality on both sides. And he spent some time channeling with George Adamski.
Right, that sounds wonderful.
So they were adventurous. He was quite an adventurous fellow, but never a doubt that he was thoroughgoing scientist, always.
Right, so what does the Confederation consist of?
It consists of over 300 societies from this Milky Way galaxy that wish to serve the Creator by being of service to others. And they have banded together to organize their efforts to serve. The Ra group explained in response to Don's questions in the Law of One, how the Confederation was set up. It was set up with something called the Council of Nine as its governing entity, which met in the rings of Saturn, obviously, in the inner planes. There isn't anything in the rings of Saturn to sit a plane down on. You'd have to be in the inner planes. But in the form of energy bodies, which higher densities find quite useful as bodies, they meet there. I believe they are still meeting there. And they are backed up by, I believe, 24 guardians of Earth. And the guardians of Earth do things like, for instance, they decided at a point long ago to put us under quarantine because of the fact that we were so far behind the power curve on getting ready for harvest. So they blocked casual visits. The only entities that get through are entities that get through according to the desires of the people of Earth. There are a lot more people on Earth that desire positive information than that desire negatively oriented information. So there's a lot more service to others contact that is manages to get through quarantine, and then there is service to self contact. But the Orion group, as the negatively oriented entities are called, also have a group, and they attempt to get through quarantine, and as they are called, they are the windows open and they're able to get through. But the preponderance of material coming from elsewhere is of service to others in its polarity as opposed to service to self. And just very briefly, service to others, it really isn't a confusing term because it's just, it's an attitude. You know many people in your life who really go through life just glad to help anybody, and just loving and giving and kind. And it's that radiance that marks the attitude of a service to others contact. The marks of a service to self contact are that they're explaining to you how important you are, how unusual you are, how special you are, and how you really are the creator, and you really need to organize the creation according to what you want to do. Now, we see this in the Army, where the generals give orders, and anything that happens from privates on up is given credit to the generals, not to the privates and on up. And in corporations, where the chief executive officer of the corporation is given credit for good business, and he gives orders and the orders are followed, and he's just looking out for his interests and his corporate interests. So we're familiar with service to others logic. We see it all the time in the world. We see it, you know, when people are trying to build an empire, or when a nation state is attempting to access natural resources for their own use and that kind of thing. So there's really not much of a mystery as to what's service to others, what's service to self. This quarantine will hold right through to the harvest.
Right. Now, the harvest is in 2012, and I read in your book that at one time the Confederation's estimate, which has changed for the better, said that the harvest would be quite small. But having said it's changed for the better, have they mentioned any specific change, i.e. can they say it's now, say, 40% rather than 10%? I mean, is
well,
there
they
any
don't
measure-
quantify.
Sorry?
No, they don't quantify it or give it a measure.
They don't.
They do say that the world is waking up with astonishing rapidity, and that what's happening is it's like people get the flu bug and they cough or they sneeze, they pass it on, and then it spreads. And we're having a pandemic of unconditional love. Of course, it flies pretty much below the radar of what's on the news.
Yes.
But people more and more are opening their hearts. They are trying to help each other. They are realizing the situation on Earth today, that we are in danger of of destroying our natural habitat here. And they're really, really wanting to change their ways and to turn around and to become of service to others and to the planet. And let me say one thing about this 2012. There's a large, usually fear-based contingent of people who are spreading doom and gloom about the winter solstice of 2012 by saying that there will be a rapture and that everything will end.
Yes.
Now, I can't prove that this isn't true. I don't think it's true. The Confederation says it's not true. But, of course, if it were true, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. We would all have finished here. And those of us who were able to graduate and go on would all be meeting in the green room before we got to walk the steps of light and find out, well, where are we going to go next? And we'd have a party. So I'm not at all concerned that this might be true. If it's true, then, you know, hey, our work will be over at the winter solstice, and it will be a delightful transition. But I don't think that's the way it's going to happen.
No,
they say that it's the planet that is switching to fourth density as its major active density on that date. The planet, like the turning of a clock, it's time. And, of course, astrology says it's time. The Mayan calendar says it's time. The somewhat discredited, but I still love it, Pyramid Inch says it's time. Even Terence McKenna's theory of rare events says it's time. It's probably time. But
yes,
for us humans, I do not think that it will be time for us to walk those steps of light and see if we've graduated third density or not until we die naturally, drop the body, take up our energy body, move into the review of the incarnation, the healing of the incarnation, and then walking those steps of light to find out where we go next.
Right. Now, you've spoken about the Earth being close to a tipping point, and you've considered, as you've just said, that everybody would be involved. But is that actually true? If there was a tipping point, would everybody go through necessarily?
No. I think that the 100th monkey effect, so-called, the idea behind the tipping point concept, is that at a certain point, the whole species begins to understand what a substantial majority of that species has learned. This is a concept from science. Science discovered that there were some monkeys on one particular part, an island that was separated from other monkeys. And at a certain point, the monkeys learned something on one island that that made it possible for them to eat better. And all of a sudden, everybody on that island knew about it. All the monkeys knew about it. And this is the hope, that eventually so many people will really get it and understand that if you make a choice of service to others and you just set your intention to help people and to love yourself and love everybody else, basically follow the golden rule, other people in your species, in the human species, will at a certain point know that too. And I think that's hopeful. We have hope that that may be true. It hasn't proven to be true yet. However, it has proven to be true that you can infect people with the attitude of service to others. You can infect people with the desire to pay it forward. You can infect people with the desire to make sure that people in Africa have water, not just the people in Europe or the people in America, that people in Africa or South America or wherever people are hurting, the Middle East, India, where people are hungry, that you want to make sure they have some food. You want to make sure these people have education. And so people are turning more to volunteerism and to more donations and trying to find ways to change the energy on Earth for the better. And I think that's the way it is spreading, not a tipping point where everybody is suddenly going to get it. I think that may be hoping for too much, but I don't know. it's possible. I'd like to think that it's possible.
Oh, it would be lovely if it included everyone in the human race. But possibly something in your book again might point to the fact that it is choice, because you do mention, obviously, that we have until the end of 2012 to make the maximum use of the last of 3D, and you say, and to choose our polarity. So presumably, if someone's decided they want to stay in 3D, it doesn't matter what else happens, they will create that reality or move to that reality because that is their intent. Would you agree with that?
I would indeed. I think that what we set our intent to do is pretty much what's possible for us. Mm. So it's always good to aim high and set that intention as to the highest and best thing that we know. Those who want to experience an enhanced environment need to get their legs under them and start using the power that they were born with, and that's the power of choice. That's why the book is called The Choice. We have that choice-making ability, and we're set up to make choices. That's the way our minds work, and that's the way our hearts work. And so, you know, just getting ourselves organized to meet that, excuse me, that moment of ethical choice is just a real precious thing to do. And we have ethical choice points all the time. Some of them are very small, you know, can I give you half my sandwich? I see that you're hungry. Some of them are very large. I think when voting day came and I went out and voted for Barack Obama here in the United States, I really felt that I had acted in service to others, because I had been increasingly horrified by choices made by the previous administration. And so I put a sign in my yard, and I put a sticker on the bumper of my car, and I voted and you know, felt as though I were doing my utmost to make a change to lighten the consciousness of planet Earth, at least over the skies of the United States. So we have choice points all the time, and when we can identify the love that is in that choice, and then we follow the love, that's acting in service to others. I think that what happens with people that really haven't made that initial choice of how they want to approach life is that they might do something nice, and then they'll turn around and do something perhaps selfish, beat somebody out of a parking place, or a job, lie or steal something, and then turn around and do another service to others thing, and they never develop enough energy either in service to self or service to others to make it past the well of indifference, as the Ra group called that point between 5% service to others and 51% service to others. If you're over 51% of the time, it's on your mind, you're intending to be of service to others.
Yes.
You're harvestable right there. You don't really have to know anything except just be of service to others, and you're already harvestable. I think the negative harvest is very difficult, because you can only have a 5% impurity in your thoughts of service to self. Anything more than 5% service to others, and you haven't even developed enough power to graduate. So you're going to stay in third density, even if you're very evil. You're just not evil enough. Hitler wasn't evil enough, which was surprising to me when the Rock group, when I channeled that in answer to Don's questions.
Right.
So it's a lot easier, I think, to graduate service to others than it is service to self.
Absolutely, yes. Now, you mentioned Obama there, which is a good reason for introducing this report that David Wilcock put out, that he has heard from reliable sources that he has already booked, that is President Obama, a two-hour worldwide TV program to go out before the end of the year, announcing the reality of our space friends. Now, you've possibly heard that. What do you think that will do? to the population.
Well, if it happens, I think that it will be a paradigm challenging event. If it happens, I've heard things like this ever since I began doing research in this area. There is always a very credible person, and I think David is definitely a credible source.
Yes.
But there are always credible sources that feel that they have gotten that information, that it is going to happen. And then it doesn't happen. Now, are they wrong? Well, you know, there's such a thing as a probability-possibility vortex. This is Ra's term. And
yes.
there is a possibility this might happen. There was a great, I think there was an even larger possibility of it when Carter came in back in the 80s because of the fact that he announced before he even became president. That was one thing he was going to do. He had seen UFOs and was convinced that it would be better if everybody were, you know, au fait with this information. But then you get into power, you run into your security people, and they say this and that, and not a good idea, and here's why. And you end up being shut down. So I absolutely feel that David is a good source. He and I are very cordial, and David has done more to turn people on to the Law of One and our channeling in general than anybody on Earth. So I hope he's right. And
so
if it does happen, I think it will be a signally positive event. But
yes.
I've seen it so often now, having been in this since the 60s. And
right.
It being 2009, we're talking about a half a century of experience here, and there has never been a year during that time when some credible source or another was not saying that it was time for everybody to know, or it was time for them to land physically, or it was time. And it never has happened yet. Now, here's what the Confederation says about that in the channeling that I've received. They say that they did try in the 50s. One last time, they talked to a fellow named Eisenhower, who at that time was president. And Eisenhower felt that it would not be a good idea to land to make their presence known. This has never been absolutely confirmed. However, I think it probably did happen because I have seen so many reports from people surrounding that situation and working
yes.
with Eisenhower at the time. And I think that Eisenhower is the kind of guy, pragmatic, practical, very experienced in a worldly sense, that, you know, he really thought about it and he thought this is not going to fly. And I think that was the last time that positively oriented UFOs have toyed with the idea of a physical contact. What the Confederation, which is service to others, positive contact, what the group is doing now is working through channels such as I and making positively oriented information available to those who wish to find it. Interestingly enough, we get hundreds, over through the years, it's been hundreds if not thousands of reports from people that when they decided to investigate what was happening outside the box, they came upon our information far faster than you would have thought. Sometimes it's because of a web search which goes from, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 and all of a sudden, bam, you're at LNL Research. It's not logical, but it happens. Or people will actually have our books fall on them or show up at the checkout counter in a bookstore. And then people try, you know, they say, I'd like to buy this book. You know, it's an interesting. And the storekeeper is going, we don't have this in our inventory, but since it's there, I guess we'll sell it to you. I mean, this has happened not just once, but dozens of times.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when people are ready for the material, it sort of comes to them by some strange mechanism that is not seen, but definitely unseen.
Yes, I have a friend who was walking through a bookshop and a book literally fell out of the shelf, sort of almost into her hands. And when she mm-hmm. looked at it, it was obviously intended for her, and she
yes.
bought it. So, yes, I've heard that type of occurrence. Now, there's an unusual link here, isn't there, between your group and Ra, who you had sessions with, and I believe David Wilcox, who is the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce, because I also read somewhere, and at the time I had tended to believe it, that Edgar Cayce was also the reincarnation of Ra, unless there's, of course, more than one Ra, but it's interesting.
Well, actually,
how
it was a fellow named Ra Ta. It was a priest at the time of Egypt that
yes, that's right.
Yeah, but it wasn't Ra, but Ra Ta, Earth guy. And yes, that's true. And it's fascinating how these things dovetail and make a web of information that all of a sudden seems to be holding. And you
yes.
have no idea, well, my goodness, you know, all these coincidences. David actually lived with us here in Louisville, Kentucky for a year.
All
and
right.
We have always had the most cordial of relations.
Oh, well, I'm not surprised, yeah. Now, what do you think will happen after 2012?
That's an interesting question, and I really do have a strong opinion there. I think that life will go on. It's sort of a... For the people of Earth, I think it's going to be the kind of non-event that Y2K was, or the harmonic convergence. Things were happening in the inner planes, but not in the physical plane. And I think that this is also true as far as Earth at the winter solstice of 2012. A lot's going to be happening in the unseen realms. The third density light, instead of waning, will be out. And the only people that will be here that will be able to use that light are those people whom I call the Indigo Children or the third wave of wanderers who are wired in their DNA to use both third density and fourth density. I think a growing percentage of the population of Earth is wired like that. Scientists are finding all kinds of strange DNA in the younger people, those born since 77. And I think what's happening after then is that there will be a small number of people who are simply finishing up their incarnations, their final incarnations of third density Earth. And whether or not they're ready, they'll walk the steps of light and they'll stop when the light becomes too bright. And then we'll discover, oh, I'm still in third density. Okay, it's time for me to repeat third grade in the School of Souls. And they'll be transferred to another planet to have another series of incarnations in third density to make their choice. It's not a penalty. It's just that's where they belong. That's where their interests are. And meanwhile, those who are able to continue walking the steps of light into denser and denser light before they stop and get uncomfortable will have graduated, will have gone on to fourth density, or in the case of many wanderers who have come from fifth and sixth density to help lighten the consciousness of planet Earth at this time, they'll just keep walking until they walk home and go back to the density whence they came. So I think that the people that are left here are people, for the most part, who not only want to help each other, they really have an overriding desire to help planet Earth, to heal third density planet Earth, to leave it in better shape than it is right now. It will heal itself over a long period of time. However, to alleviate the adhering karma that has been collected by people such as those who came from Mars, those who came from Maldek, and other planets which were rendered uninhabitable during third density by their inhabitants. There is this sense of the desire to love the Earth, to become better stewards of the Earth. And you can see the waves and waves of good energy coming from people who are trying to get back to to being good stewards of the earth, to growing good food to eat, and to being kind to Mother Earth, to cleaning up the water, cleaning up the air, cleaning up the soil, planting trees again so the deserts will go away, and just working very lovingly and carefully and thoughtfully to express their service to others, orientation with regard to the planet itself, which is, of course, a living entity. In fact, one of the surprises I had when I very first began channeling was that we were asking questions about Earth, and all of a sudden I had Earth. I was talking to an entity called Earth.
Right.
I was talking to the planet.
Yeah.
And it was a fascinating, I don't think that the tape recorder was on at that time, though. Don started taping my sessions a couple of months after I began learning, but this was while I was still learning. So I'll never forget the shock that I had in talking to planet Earth itself. She was a lovely lady.
So, looking back, you would probably say that was Mother Gaia.
Yes, it was indeed. It was indeed, yes. And she has such love for us.
Right. Now, you've been talking mainly about the third density there. So the people that move into the fourth density, will they simply disappear from sight because they're in the higher vibration and be in a level still around the old Earth? Or will they actually be progressing to a new Earth?
Well, the densities are nested. So you have all of the densities nested. And once you grasp the fact that there isn't any such thing actually as mass, there are just energy fields, you can see how there's plenty of room to nest all of the densities of Earth together and have them interpenetrate. So we're interpenetrated with fourth density now. And as our third density light wanes and dies, fourth density light dawns and becomes brighter and starts its scroll of unwinding progression through that density. So I think that it is out of courtesy to third density that we don't see the fourth density entities now. And I think that when the last purely third density entity is gone, we'll start seeing fourth density, just like we in third density now see animals and plants in second density and the elements and the powers like, you know, earth, air, water, fire, in first density. They interpenetrate and they can be seen, but the Confederation has said quite a few times that there is a matter of basic good manners, which would mean that you do not blow third density people's minds by appearing in fourth density, which has so much more light, so much more information, and so forth. What you're getting in third density, however, is this interpenetrating fourth density light, this light of truth that has so much more information, and that is pretty much, especially as third density light wanes, it's forcing the people that are working to make their choice, to make the choice, to see everything about themselves that they did not want to see. It's all coming up and demanding to be noticed so that it can be integrated into the self, and so that the self can gather itself into the open heart, forgive itself, accept itself, and love itself.
Right.
Oh, I wanted to tell you before our hour is up,
yes?
You asked last time that you said, I would like to get to auras next time, so I thought I'd remind you of that. I don't know if there's time, but I just wanted to put that in front of you.
Oh, yes. Now, you've mentioned the indigo children. What role do they have at this time?
Well, as I said, the indigo children are those with double wiring. And although certainly they came here for personal reasons, they came here to learn, to balance themselves, and they came here to serve. As we all do, by just simply holding a space for the light to shine through us. I think their interest is largely the planet itself. They're interested in offering themselves as those who are healers in stewardship to Mother Gaia. And although, of course, they want to be of service to the people of Earth, they actually are focused more deeply on the planet itself and restoring 3D planet Earth to a more healed condition than it is now.
Yes. Do you believe that over this period of time, up to the end of 2012, that there will be major changes of a physical nature on the Earth? I mean, sort of bordering on catastrophic incidents?
I do. This was something that I remember when I first began going to meditations at Don Elkin's group in the 60s. There was a book out called This is the Earthquake Generation, and they were talking about how it seemed inevitable that we would have a planetary shift in 1998, which is Casey had predicted it when he was alive back in the 30s. The Confederation says, you know, that almost happened. But groups such as L&L Research sprang up all over the planet in the intervening time, and the situation was alleviated. It was almost as though the situation were that of a rubber band being held and just about ready to be let go on one end, so it snapped, and that would be the planetary shift. And instead, it was gradually lessened in tension and gradually released so that at no time was there a planetary catastrophe, but each time that it was a little bit of the heat that had been generated by disharmonious vibrations among the people of Earth throughout all these thousands of years of this major cycle was let go. There was a tsunami, there was a hurricane, there was an earthquake.
Yes.
And so we see Mother Earth trying desperately not to shake us off like fleas, trying instead to have a little bit released here, a little bit released there, of the heat that's been stored in the planet from all of our contumely, our desire for empire, our wars, and our disdain for each other. This has damaged Mother Earth, and she has to release this energy as she goes into fourth density. So I think what you're seeing here is not bad news, but excellent news, great news, because you're seeing, okay, instead of the whole planet having to go through a planetary shift that would make, you know, oil deposits of us all sometime in the future, we're seeing localized catastrophes that took a few lives but spared the great many others, and this happens again.
We'll have to stop you there because we are coming up to the last couple of minutes, believe it or not. take a minute to give our listeners your website address where they may get more information about the book and details on how to buy it.
All right. Our archives are at www.llresearch.org. And there you can find over 1,500 of my channeling sessions, almost all of my books. They're all downloadable for free. And my speeches, interviews like this one, we get a recording of that, and then we put the text up. Anything that we can put up that may help seekers, that may be useful for them, we try to make that available. The store and the chat room and the blog room and all kinds of forums and so forth are on our spiritual community site, which is www.bringforth, which is B-R-I-N-G and the Arabic numeral 4th.org. And on Bring Forth, there is the store. There are my daily Camelot Journal entries. If you want to find out what's up at L&L Research, you just click on that. I write an article once every week or two for UPI, which is called the Small, Medium, at Large. And you can click on that and read my articles, or you can contact LL Research.
Right. Okay, that's wonderful, Carla. I'll have to leave you there. I've got to quickly announce next week's guest. It's been lovely to have you back, and it's been terrifically interesting, and I really don't know where the time went so quickly. So thank you again. And dear listeners, I have to say that I have someone next week who doesn't really need introducing. It's Susie Ward, well known for her channeled messages for Matthew, her son. And we will be discussing her book, which is about her conversations with animals. So that should be very interesting. So thank you for being with me today. I do hope you can be with me next week. Thank you very much, everyone.